This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, organizers of the 22nd annual Learn to Homebrew Day, coming up on Saturday, November 7th. Learn to Homebrew Day is an opportunity to celebrate and spread the joy of one of the most rewarding and delicious activities of all time. Pledge to brew this November 7th and receive a promo code for $5 off a one-year American Homebrewers Association membership. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to learn more. homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 8th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, mad fermentationist and founder of Sapwood Cellars, Mike Tonsmeyer, joins us to talk about English Imperial Stout. Mike goes back to the roots of the Imperial style to brew some thick and delicious beers. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Well, the year 2020 continues to fill with bad news. We heard earlier this week of the passing of Mike Tasty McDole, who, through his work at the Brewing Network, added a tremendous amount to our brewing knowledge and was a heck of a nice guy on top of that. I didn't know Tasty well, but I did get to spend some time hanging out with him in New Zealand at the first New Zealand homebrew conference. We Americans, including Tasty, John Palmer, Chris Colby, and Andy Sparks, took part in panels, toured hop production facilities, and even brewed batches of beer in front of a crowd. Mike Tasty McDole, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio. I talked to you during the long shot competition thing.
That was a long time ago. Yeah.
Well, Basic Brewing Radio was really basic then, I bet. Look at you now. It's so elaborate. This equipment you got is just amazing.
here with my one microphone, my one recorder. It's good to spend some, I was telling John that it's good to spend some time with you guys. We see in passing at the events.
Then we're really busy. If like you see me like at the National Home Brewers Conference, I'm like all over the place. Sometimes I just want to go in the corner and like be by myself.
Yes.
It's not a good time sometimes. I mean, it's great. I love it. I love the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 home brewers in one place. Can't be any more fun than that.
And all of them want a picture with you.
So. I do a lot of pictures. I had a lot of pictures here today. Yeah, for sure.
So what do you got brewing here?
And
let me say that I'm not much intimidated brewing right next to you here.
It's no big deal. It's just a basic IPA. It's be about 6.2%. We're using obviously the domestic New Zealand hops here. I'm using their Chinook and their Cascade primarily, just so I can sort of like, I probably won't get to have the barrel though. It'd be nice if they sent us a case. But I'd like to see how it would compare to like our hops. I'm very familiar with this sort of like malt profile, so it'd be a pretty good comparison.
Talk about the malt profile.
Well, I'm using about 80% pale malt, New Zealand pale malt from Gladfield, and then about 14% their Pilsner malt. And then about, I think it's like 4% crystal, they call it light crystal. Probably looks like it's like our crystal 40 or English 45. And then about 4% is acidulated malt, trying to get the drinking pH down kind of low.
What's your hop strategy? I mean, when are you going to, the weighted percentages of where you're going to add the hops, essentially?
Well, this beer is going to be about, starting gravity about 1058, so... You know, I do kind of like a beer like this. I'll do like a one-to-one. Then that calls for like 58 IBUs, right? So I'll do half of that as a 60-minute addition. And then the other half, like 10 minutes in later.
Mike McDole leaves the world more tasty through his legacy. How many times this year have I had to transition from horrible news back to the flow of the show? It's always clumsy, and I wish I knew how to do it better, frankly. But the good news is that there is not much left of 2020. Before I forget again, Steve and I are planning to do our annual disaster show at the end of the year. I'm already getting disaster stories coming in, and I don't know yet when we'll record the show. So get your story in to james@basicbrewing.com, and I'll be rustling up some prizes at some point in the proceedings. So turn your bad news into good news. Speaking of good news, Ricky from Groenfell Meadery says they're adding two states to their distribution, West Virginia and, drumroll, Arkansas. I was stunned when I heard that, but Ricky says Groenfell is one of a few producers able to ship to my home state because of a small change in legislation. And Ricky says that he and Kelly should have three more states to announce in the next few weeks. You know, we love Groenfell and Chaos Meads. They are moderate gravity, most are carbonated, which makes them extremely drinkable, and of course, they're delicious. And now you can build your own variety case and automatically get 10% off and free shipping to your house. There are also mead homebrew recipes if you want to brew your own at Groenfell.com and see what goes into their meads. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram to see the latest info because, you know, sometimes they have pre-releases and they go fast. So you can get delicious craft mead shipped to even more places on Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. I did a bit of benchmarking this past weekend. You know, I made my own mango hard seltzer, and we'll have a video episode later this month on that. Well, I decided to buy some mango White Claw to see how mine measured up to a commercial example. And I feel a whole lot better about my homebrew example now. I don't want to get too negative, but man, how do you drink that stuff? It's if all commercial hard seltzers taste that way, you need to make your own to save your friends and relatives from that fate, because it can be done better. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Ralph from Gainesville, Florida writes after hearing Adam Ross talking about Dumpf beer and Tapache. Ralph says, I listened to your latest episode of Basic Brewing Radio this morning when you talked with Adam Ross. Just by pure coincidence, I have a keg of Dumpf beer on tap right now. The source I used was in the Style Spotlight from the November-December 2013 issue of Zymergy. I missed that one. Either that or I read it and forgot it. I used 65% Pils malt with 35% Munich malt and a 1 ounce edition of Carafa 1 for some color, a single edition of Tradition hops at 60 minutes and fermented at 65 degrees Fahrenheit. It turned out to be a nice summer drink with notes of banana and clove. Ralph says, I named it Wesley's Wheatless Weissbier after my brew buddy and dog Wesley. Aw, good dog Wesley. Thanks, Ralph. I appreciate that. Not coincidentally, it happened on purpose. Yesterday, I brewed my own attempt at a Dumpf beer using 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms of 10 Lovibond Munich, 1 pound or 450 grams of 20 Lovibond Munich, and an ounce of Hallertau Mittelfrüh hops just for bittering at 60 minutes. And I did a no-chill, and today I'm going to pitch G01 Stefan from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. Stefan is a Hefeweizen yeast, so I'm hoping it will bring out a delicious banana and clove character in my Dumpf beer. I've also added a new recipe to our recipe section on basicbrewing.com using Stefan. It's Gary's Hefeweizen from Gary Batliner at Imperial. Gary is in charge of growing the yeast at Imperial, so he's an important guy. His recipe uses a three-step mash and features red wheat, Pilsner malt, with a little rye. Gary says he thinks the rye plays well with the clove notes from the Imperial Stefan yeast. So now our recipe section has doubled in size, meaning we got two now. Check it out at basicbrewing.com/recipes. We love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters for standard gravity 5-gallon batches. And at a pitch rate of 200 billion cells in each of those easy-to-open pouches, it's no wonder. Ask your local homebrew store for Imperial Organic Yeast or head over to imperialyeast.com. We also heard through the mailbag of some commercial examples of tepache, which is that naturally fermented pineapple drink that Adam talked about. Thomas writes in and says, Arcus Cidery outside of Austin has released tepache in the past, and Alan from Tacoma, but now living in Missouri, says Dos Luces Gluten-Free Brewing in Denver has done a tepache as well as chicha and pulque. And Alan says he met the Dos Luces brewer at GABF back in happier times, and that their beers were pretty great, according to Alan. So I appreciate that, and thanks everybody for the info. It's always good when we hear from listeners out there with more info than we have. Speaking of tasty beers, our sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa have released a new kit, Solid AF Citra Pale Ale. I'm assuming AF stands for Awesomely Flavorful. This is a beer that apparently is a favorite at Pippin's Tap Room, but now you can brew it yourself in your own dang house. It's the first of High Gravity's Essential Hop Series. The beer has all the things, Desiree and Dave say, citrus, grapefruit, lime, tropical fruits, and just the right amount of bitterness. Solid AF Citra Pale Ale. On highgravitybrew.com, you can get extract or all grain. And don't forget to check out the winter and holiday kit selections, because if you buy more than one ingredient kit, you get a 10% discount applied at checkout. And of course, if you have your own recipe, you can use the super handy Build Your Own Beer page on highgravitybrew.com. And of course, you can take a couple extra minutes to drool over their electric brewing gear, too. You know, we love Desiree and Dave. They take the pain out of propane at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, it's been way too long since I've talked to Mike Tonsmeyer of Sapwood Cellars. I checked his Mad Fermentationist blog to see what he's been up to and got thirsty reading about what he calls English Imperial Stout. Mike Tonsmeyer, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
My pleasure as always, James.
It's been a long time. I've talked to your partner, Scott, more than I've talked to you lately.
Yeah, I think Skype told me I hadn't had a call with you since March 2019, so 18 months is a long time for us to go without catching up anyway.
That's crazy. Was there a homebrew conference between here and there, or am I things are for some reason all the time mileposts are confused in my head. I don't know what day it is. I don't know what month it is. All I know is I'm still at home, so I can...
Yeah, you're right though, because we got together and chatted at HomebrewCon in Providence, Rhode Island, a couple of months after that, but still more than a year ago.
Right. Okay. Well, it's time. It's time that we got together. I went on your blog and I said I hadn't talked to Mike in a while. Let's see what he's been up to. And I saw a post way back from May. Was it May?
Yeah. Which is also disturbingly the most recent post on my blog. But lets you know how much less time I have to write now that I work at a brewery than when I was at a desk job 9 to 5.
Yeah. Now that you're not, working for the federal government, writing your blog at, at your desk. just a joke. I'm sure for anybody listening, just a joke. So you've been busy. How are things at Sapwood Cellars?
Really good. We were lucky with the size we were and where we were when the whole shutdown and quarantine and pandemic thing hit. But we've sort of pivoted to mostly canning beer. But as the tasting room is reopening and whatever, we're actually going through a little bit of an expansion to add some more capacity so we can have cans to go, but also have some draft for in-house. And our sour program and our bottles are still churning along. It took a little while to get going, but we've have a release every 3 or 4 weeks for the most part. We just did a honey saison in white wine barrels was the most recent one.
Wow. And are things going along according to the business plan, or is or has this kind of knocked you in a different direction?
It's similar to the business plan. We had actually attempted to order new tanks last December, and whether it was a result of them coming from China and COVID, but they were lost in transit or never shipped or something happened, and we ended up having to reorder a couple of months ago. So that delayed us a little bit, but honestly, it worked out fine. We really didn't need that extra capacity for the first half of the year. And so we're my brewer Ken is actually back there right now going through the passivation steps on the new tanks, and we'll be brewing into one of them on Friday, hopefully a hoppy lager with our friends over at Astrolab in Silver Spring.
Wow. And you're expanding not only in equipment, but also in space and real estate as well.
Yeah, we've got sort of 3 units in this office park we're in now, and we just signed a lease for a 4th unit. I wish it was right next to us, but it's one more unit down. We have M and O, and this is K rather than L, sadly. So it'll be a little bit of a pain moving all of our barrels and all of our sour beer gear to this extra unit, but it's probably nice to have a little bit more physical separation, you know, keep those microbes and all their associated equipment as far away from our clean beers as possible.
You're going to have like a scrub zone between, between
yeah,
one place and another.
Our friends of ours have a brewery, and they have a policy that if you go over there, you're going home for the night after you go, and they've got little booty dispensers, and they've got little drip trays that you have to step in sanitizer before coming back out. We'll see if we're that paranoid, but so far so good. We've been open 2 years and haven't had any cross contamination issues or anything like that.
Just need to rewatch the Andromeda Strain.
Yeah.
And get some ideas.
not sure that's the best thing to watch right now, but yeah,
that's true. I was thinking of changing clothes and different colored, you know, coveralls and things like that for different
clean
areas.
Room, and yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think about the whole premise of the whole movie. Oh, my goodness. So the post that I saw was on the title of it caught my attention, English Imperial Stouts. You know, we're used to hearing about Russian Imperial Stouts, but what the heck is an English Imperial Stout?
Yeah, so I mean, really what I was trying to get across was that, you know, I think Russian Imperial Stout has now become a much more generic term for big, roasty stouts. And some people are just calling it Imperial Stout. Some people still say Russian Imperial Stout. But this was me hearkening back to the original versions that were brewed in England for export to the Russian Imperial Court. And, you know, sort of the grandfather of all the imperial stouts, but, you know, a tradition that mostly died out in England and was, you know, sort of, as many styles have been, revived by American craft brewers.
And what's the difference? I mean, how have we strayed away from that original example?
Sure. I mean, I think, and particularly now, when we brew a sort of standard imperial stout, it is really roasty, and it probably has some darker crystal malts in it, maybe Special B, maybe Crystal 120, you know, that big dark fruit kind of flavor. We're certainly pushing the final gravities up. I mean, I think people across the board are really responding to beers that have a little bit more of a sweet flavor. And so for our sort of standard, we have a beer called Time Stream on now that started at about 1.125 and finishes at about 10.48, I think. And that's, it's, I mean, it's 10.3% alcohol. So, I mean, it's a big beer, but it's not massive. But when you have a beer that has, and that one has, I think pretty close to maybe 15% dark malts between a lot of Carafa Special, but then also some roasted barley and some chocolate malts. And when you have that much roast, you know, it's like coffee with a couple of sugars in it, that sweetness helps to round it out. It really makes it a friendly beer for adjuncts. You know, we're working on a banana peanut butter version of it. We've done coconut vanilla. We've done bourbon barrel aged coffee. We've done the Mexican hot chocolate kind of idea with chili peppers and cacao nibs and cinnamon and vanilla. And for us, I mean, you know, whether you want to call that a pastry stout or just sort of a flavored imperial stout, you know, it's a base that's really roasty, toasty, sweet, you know, layers of flavor. In a lot of cases, can be, you know, a decent amount of bitterness from hops, versus that classic English was a much sort of cleaner, simpler beer. You know, going back into the 19th century, there weren't a lot of crystal malts. There wasn't a, you know, I mean, we just have so many maltsters now and so many different choices on malts and specialty malts and whatever. But, you know, those historic stouts and porters were, you know, pale malt, amber, brown, and black, and that's about it. Maybe some caramelized sugar, whether in sort of more traditionally like a brewer's caramel 4 or whatever it is. But we all often use candy syrup just because that's a relatively easy and somewhat similar product.
Hmm. Now, these beers, you know, finishing it out at like 1050, 1048, 1050,
yeah.
You know, they're so chunky you want to eat them with a fork, but you use a spoon to get every bite. But
so I mean, someone recently called that beer as a knife and fork beer.
You want to have pancakes. But you got to think, though, that with all the alcohol, that it doesn't. Does it taste that thick? I mean, surely it doesn't. I mean, it's almost like a hot scotchy.
Yeah, no, it's surprising the number. And I don't put a huge amount of stock in what people on Untappd say, because and we could talk about that sometime. But there are some swings and misses. But the number of people who say, hey, our particular version is, you know, sweet, but it's not sticky sweet or syrupy sweet. You know, we've filled, you know, 5 cases worth of crowlers of it. I can tell you it's sticky. I mean, your fingers will start being glued together. Your gloves will be tacky by the end of it. But yeah, exactly. And that's sort of the idea that the sweetness is in balance with, you know, the alcohol, the roast, the hot bitterness. And the more you want to push those things, the more the sweetness comes up. And that's what we found with IPAs and double IPAs too, is we tend to be a little bit more bitter than a lot of other breweries are with their hazy, juicy New England IPAs. And because we're adding more hops on the hot side and more bitterness, we're also ending up pushing that final gravity up into the 10-20s just to balance it out.
I used to get questions back in the day from brewers who said, oh, my beer finished at, you know, X finishing gravity. Is it stuck? Is my fermentation stuck? And one of the questions that I learned to ask was, well, what was your starting gravity? You know, because if you start at, you know, 1080 or 1100 and you get down to like, you know, 1020, your debt's pretty good.
Yeah. And really, in the end, I mean, the question should be, how does it taste?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be too worried about what the numbers say unless the answer is, yeah, it's too sweet. Then we can think about drying it out. But if it is, and we've had some lower gravity stouts that have stopped a little higher than we would have expected. And hey, as a 5% beer instead of a 5.5% beer, it's still delicious. And there's no sense in jumping through a bunch of hoops to get to exactly that that final gravity that you had put into the recipe before you brewed it. You know, but maybe worth thinking about tweaking things in the future, whether that's to keep the gravity that high or whether it's to drive it down a little bit further.
And what do you do as far as yeast health or, you know, taking care of the yeast or pitching the yeast to make sure that you are actually hitting that you're not actually getting a stuck fermentation or you are actually finishing as low as you want?
Yeah, it really depends on exactly what we're trying to do. For the English Imperial Stouts, we keep a English strain, you know, in the neighborhood of a 1318, a Boddington's, a London Fog, you know, whatever you want to call it. That's what we use for our primary fermentation on our pale ales and our IPAs. And so we'll just harvest from hopefully whatever low alcohol beer we're brewing and pitch a whole lot of cells into the stout. And then on top of that, as a brewery, we have inline aeration. So as the wort exits the heat exchanger, it goes through a tube that has a stone in it. And we can just pump in oxygen for the whole knockout, part of the knockout, at whatever rate we choose.
Let's take a quick break from talking to Mike to talk about our friends and sponsors at Tavor. If you listen to this show, you know about Tavor. It's a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered to you. It's not a Beer of the Month club where someone chooses beer for you. You only pay for the beer that you choose over the course of the month. Signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, and download their iPhone or Android app. You'll receive notifications for two new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes. This month, look for selections from Oliphant, Human Robot, Wild State Cider, B-52, and Union Craft. If you're not interested in the beers that you see, no worries. Just click the one or skip the ones that you don't want. However, when you do see something that you do want, don't wait. Just click on it and add it to your crate. Your beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing you enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping. Why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up. There's no obligation to purchase anything. In fact, if I can ask you a favor, go to Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or download the app, and when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, all one word, and you get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. So again, it's free to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase. Sign up at Tavor.com or with the Tavor app and enter Basic Brewing as the promo code. Let's talk about the recipe on your website here, the Courage Russian Imperial Stout Clone. And is that the recipe that you've basically been using to, you know, as a springboard on the stouts that you've been brewing there?
Yeah, no, and I did two different versions of it at home. My good friend James, not you, James, different James, and I brewed it, I'm going to say 12 or 13 years ago now for the first time. And it was really a little bit based on sort of the concept of it, but I also talked to Ron Pattinson of Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, and he sent me I would have to find the exact year, but it was like a 1937 brew sheet from what it was called, the catchy name IBS, Imperial Brown Stout, when it was, because that was after Courage had been bought out. So that was when it was Barclay, at that point had sort of taken over for them. And so he sent that to me, and that was sort of, that had a little bit more brown malt than sort of the original version I had brewed, and, had some other tweaks. And so the second version I did was a lot more sort of inspired by that real historic version. But, you know, as some things go, the most authentic version is not necessarily the best version. I really like that first one I did that had a little bit less brown malt. Brown malt can be a little bit acrid, a little bit too assertive when you've got a lot of roast and a lot of other flavors going on. So I actually, for the version we did at Sapwood, basically went back to that original recipe, other than rounding a little bit different, you know, not using 45 pounds of amber malt from a sack, using the whole 55 pounds, that kind of thing. But otherwise, it was very similar. I think the only other thing we may have changed, we've found that a lot of the English malts, when you really start pushing the other grains that are in there, just don't have quite enough diastatic oomph to do a great conversion. So often we'll add 10, 15, 20% American pale two row, just to make sure that there's enough enzymes in there to deal with the amber malt, the brown malt, which may not be exactly the same as the amber and the brown malt that were made 75, 150 years ago.
This recipe that I'm looking at has a Golden Promise, Maris Otter, amber malt, dark candy sugar syrup, black patent malt, and corn sugar and brown malt. And in talking to Peter Simons about, you know, these historical, you know, English beers and, you know, the Australian beers that were based on those, you know, they weren't shy about using sugar.
Yeah. No, and particularly, what's his name? He's from Zebulon Artisan Ales. Mike Karnowski, have you talked to him?
No.
He's terrific. He runs a little brewery down in Asheville, and he loves historic beers, and he makes his own caramels.
Ah.
And so he's talked about doing that, you know, that the caramels that you have to add, I think you often add a little citric acid to invert them, and then you cook them for 4 or 5 hours, and you just slowly keep adding a little bit of water so the temperature doesn't get too high, but you can keep getting these caramelization reactions. And he does his historic stouts with that. So far, I have been too lazy to attempt something like that. But that's sort of candy syrup is made in a different way. Candy syrup is generally a Maillard reaction. So they're actually adding a source of nitrogen, whether that's just unrefined beet sugar or whether that might be people at home use like even we were talking about DAP, mm-hmm. yeast nutrient,
mm-hmm.
Is a great source of nitrogen and can be used to create those sorts of flavors. It happens much faster, and there are different compounds created than a pure caramelization. But in a lot of cases, you're getting some of the same kinds of darker caramel, maybe some fruit flavors, maybe some slightly, you know, toffee burnt kind of flavors as well.
Yeah, Steve and I attempted to make Belgian candy syrup on one video podcast, and we made something, and it was it was real thick, but you know we put it in the beer and it fermented and tasted good, so you know you can be forgiven that you don't want to experiment with that. It's a messy, you know, and potentially dangerous process. You know, hot sugar is not fun to play with.
And like I've done a pound or two at home for experiments, but it's another one to try to come up with 50 or 100 pounds of something like that. You know, as you said, messy and dangerous, and particularly if it doesn't turn out well, or even if it does turn out well as a commercial brewery, you'd like to have consistency. And, you know, if cooking it a little bit longer, a little bit hotter, a little bit differently doesn't yield the same results, and you go to brew the beer again in a year and the result is totally different, that's certainly not a helpful thing.
So typically or a lot of times when people add sugar to a recipe, like when you add, you know, some sucrose to a you know, like a double IPA, mm-hmm. you're wanting it to dry out. You're wanting to dry out the beer. But I take it that in this recipe, does the sugar have the same effect? I mean, if you didn't add the sugar and you added some other kind of, you know, fermentables of the same weight, how do you think that would affect things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly does help to dry it out. And we're certainly mashing when we are adding sugar like that. We're mashing a little bit warmer than we would otherwise. These beers start so big and still finish big. And so for more of the English, and so we call ours Lord Rupert Everton, which is a reference to The Office. It's the wacky character Michael Scott, sort of his English alter ego. It finishes in the mid 1020s. I would have to look exactly 1026, 1028, something like that. So it's certainly on the drier side of these big dark beers that we do, partly because it isn't as roasty. It's not especially strongly bittered, and so it doesn't need quite as much sweetness to kind of balance out those other flavors.
I just did. I brewed up the next malt sampler yesterday, comparing Black Patent against Black Prinz and mm-hmm. Midnight Wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of misconceptions about Black Patent. You know, a lot of people think Black Patent is acrid or, you know, is ashy or.
Yep.
But what do you find that it brings to the beers?
You know, I think what people are often tasting when they taste those things is tasting the low pH. When you add a lot of dark malt, you really need to both for, you know, getting good conversion, but then also the flavor of the finished beer. You know, adding chalk can work, although it's not especially effective. We use baking soda in a lot of our beers in the mash, And then if the boil pH drops further than we want, we'll add chalk at that point. And then in the really big, really roasty ones, we'll add slaked lime, pickling lime. And that's a very effective way to raise the pH without adding a lot of excess sodium. If you're already, you have enough sodium for flavor. I like 50 or 75 parts per million of sodium in my dark beers if they're going to be a little sweeter. But with some of these sort of over the top beers, it would, you know, would probably be at 150 or 200 parts per million of sodium, you know, almost tasting like probably not quite to Goza levels, but not too far off of that.
Hmm.
And so Black Patent to me has just like a really nice chocolatey rounded, you know, it certainly has a little bit of char to it, but it's definitely not ashy or anything like that. And having enough sweetness to back it up too, again, helps to alleviate that if you're sensitive to, you know, espresso or black coffee, you know, a little of that, but with some sugar behind it can be nice and can be a good counterpoint to that sweetness.
So to the base beer, you've been playing with doing things like a barrel aging and adding Brett as well?
Yeah, certainly most beers that were being brewed 150 or 200 years ago, if it was going into oak, it was going to get, you know, they used to say stale, but not stale in the sense of stale bread, just stale in the sense of an aged vinous, you know, richer flavor. And so for the very first version of the beer, I just added some oak cubes. And then it was right around the time that Y Yeast was discontinuing Brettanomyces anomalous. It turned out, I think they'd gotten it tested. It was really Brettanomyces bruxellensis. And again, you know, in 2007, you know, I guess they just didn't feel that there was a need to have another Brett Brux strain that has slightly different flavor profile. So they discontinued it, but my local homebrew store knew that I liked Brett and said, hey, you know, I've got a pack of this. They're discontinuing it if you want to play with it. I did a 100% Brett beer, and I add some to this. And I really liked it. It was a relatively subtle flavor, but gave it just a little sort of leathery, vinous, aged kind of thing. But I got nervous that it was going to dry out too much, and so I ended up finding it with gelatin and transferring it and adding some Campton tablets, some metabisulfite, to stop the Brett.
Ah.
And surprisingly, it worked. It knocked the Brett down far enough that even in the bottle for, I just opened the very last bottle of it when I wrote that article a couple of months ago, at you know, more than 12 years in the bottle, it still tasted great. It never got overcarbonated. It stopped at about 10-20. And yeah, worked out beautifully.
Hmm.
So that had been discontinued. And then a couple years later, when I went to brew the rebrew at home, I had an old bottle of that 100% Brett beer, and I tried to grow it up, and it didn't really work. And I ended up using Brett C, Brett Clausenii. And it was a little more aggressive. It was a little funkier. I thought it clashed a little bit because, again, I mean, this isn't a super roasty beer, but just roast and funk can be a tricky balance. The phenolic thing with the roast, the drier thing with the roast. And so when we brewed our version of it at Sapwood, the idea was to keg off about half the batch, you know, maybe 10 kegs of it, plain as is, no Brett, no wood. And then we got a couple of, I think they're about 80-gallon barrels from Sagamore Spirits in Baltimore. And they had originally been cognac barrels that then they'd done a cognac finished rye whiskey in. So we got those. And then I decided, hey, I'm a professional brewery now. I'm going to email Y Yeast and see, you know, I'm sure they can just give me, you know, for a couple $100, a commercial pitch of the Brett A. And they said, nope, we don't sell it anymore. We destroyed our stock of it. It's gone.
Wow.
And so I posted on, you know, some of the American Homebrewing Association forums on yeast wrangling and on Milk the Funk, and eventually got directed to a guy in France named Christophe Pinchon, who is sort of a fantastic and wonderful resource for microbes. He stockpiles them. And we'd used a friend of a friend had given us a Brett strain he'd harvested from a Berliner Weiss that we used and had great results with. So I emailed him, and he checked his stock and luckily for us had it and you know, grew it up and tested it and sent a sample our way. And just recently I sent him back some of the finished beer and then sort of another selection of our beers as a thank you for sending it.
Wow.
But oddly, the culture he sent started right up. It really, you know, the starter looked great, and I pitched about a liter of it into each of the two barrels, and it didn't do much. It didn't really lower the gravity, and I think that there is a little Brett flavor, but it's debatable. Some people, my tasting room manager, Spencer, whose palate I really trust, said, yep, I get Brett right off the top, and then some other people have said, no, you know, it just tastes like a barrel-aged stout to me. And so whether it was, you know, that the strain maybe had lost its ability to ferment more complex sugars or what over, you know, 12 years in storage, I don't know. But we were still very happy with the beer, but it definitely was not as funky, bready as the original version I'd brewed.
Huh. Well, that's kind of sad that, you know, hopefully that's not something that's just disappeared.
Yeah, and that's the trick. And that's, I mean, I've never understood. I always appreciate when yeast labs learn something new about a strain, but it doesn't stop them from selling it. You know, it, just because Brett Trois from White Labs turned out not to be Brettanomyces, it still makes great beer, and now they sell as Saccharomyces Trois. That's fine. You know, it, to me, it doesn't really matter what the classification of something is. It, you know, does it make good beer? Do I want to use it? Kind of is irrelevant to, is it technically an ale or a lager strain, or is it Brettanomyces or, you know, something else?
Yeah, especially in these days of all these quote-unquote new, you know, like Kvike strains that have been around for hundreds of years and hanging in people's barns with, you know, bird poop on them. And, and you know, they're starting to be shared everywhere. You know, it's good to keep track of what's what, but, you know.
But to use that as a tool for, you know, oh, well, it's not Brettanomyces. Maybe I feel more comfortable with it in my my clean fermenters. But in the same breath, well, maybe this strain is Diastaticus, and even if it's a brewer's yeast, it's a Saccharomyces diastaticus, maybe I don't want it in my clean beer. Maybe it's safer with the sour beer if it's, you know, could have the same effect as Brett, even if it's not Brett.
I think it was you who sent us the first 100% Brett beer that we tried.
Could have been. That was. I think we did like a weird fermentations or something where I'd mixed kombucha with something and maybe had 100% Brett beer and
that beer was super clean. We were amazed at how super clean it was.
Yeah.
And I think that you probably did the, you know, I do these hop samplers all the time now, but you probably did. I was thinking this morning that you were probably the originator of the hop sampler because you sent us like a 6-pack. Of or an assortment of beers that you brewed with, you know, single hop, and each of those were, you know, 6-pack brews.
That was the first time I was on the show. I think I just emailed you to say, hey, your small batch brewing or whatever had inspired me to do that. I went about probably the most annoying way possible. I made 5 gallons of wort and then like individually boiled 1 gallon of it like 6 times. That was a long day.
Well, I did.
No, but we still do that kind of thing at the brewery. We'll steal 5 gallons of an IPA before we dry hop it with whatever the plan is. And then, hey, use Strata or use Sabro or use HBC 47, whatever. You know, we're trying to still learn like that. You know, that's how you keep making great beer and stay relevant, is not just do the same thing over and over and over again.
Small batches for the win.
Yeah. and it's fun having a tasting room because then it's not just the us trying it, but we can put it on tap and people can come in and see if they like it and, you know, learn something. And, you know, so we have a lot of regulars who are home brewers or even other local brewers who come here to, you know, try something out and not have to go through the hoops of brewing it themselves.
If someone is going to make one of these big old, either English, whatever you want to call it, imperial stouts, what are the keys that they've got to think about either if they're formulating their own recipe or if they're looking at somebody else's recipe?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that, depending on your setup, may be an issue is mash tun capacity. When we opened the, we were thinking our biggest beer would be, 1085, 1090 maybe. And making these beers that are 1120, 1130. I mean, a lot of these, the places doing the stouts that people really are seeking after are starting at 1140, 1150 even. And, just a regular size mash tun that's, for a homebrew doing a 5 gallon batch, a 10 gallon mash tun, something like that, may not be big enough. What we do, I'm sure other breweries do something similar, is we do two mashes for one boil. And so rather than, getting all of our wort with a sparge and getting into the kettle and boiling it all together, we'll get about, for a 10-barrel batch, get about 7 barrels of wort into the kettle, start the boil, and then while that's going on, we'll do the second batch and the second runoff into the kettle and end up doing about a 4-hour boil.
Yeah.
And even with that, we're often adding a bag of malt extract or a bag of or a thing of candy syrup or something else that will allow us to boost the gravity without having to wring more extract out of our grain.
There's
a home brewer,
there's a ceiling on efficiency. I mean, I talked about it with Chris Colby on the show before. If you're you can't put twice as much grain in your mash tun with the same amount of water and expect to get twice the fermentables out. With a big beer like this, you're going to have to collect basically two beers worth of wort and then boil it down to, one beer's worth of volume to get your numbers up.
Yeah. And so that's the sort of the first thing to consider is just with your setup, how much grain is the most grain you can put in? Honestly, I mean, even at this scale, there's nothing wrong with malt extract. Malt extract, particularly in a beer that's so driven by specialty malts, I really don't notice much difference. And even I've heard from some breweries that have gotten bigger systems and didn't have to use malt extract anymore, actually found that they were missing out on whatever flavor they were getting from the malt extract, or maybe the more concentrated boil you're getting, more Maillard reactions. I know that's a move at home I'd stolen from Hair of the Dog in Portland, Oregon, who does some of the best big, strong, interesting beers in the country. They'll often boil down below their target volume and then water back just to allow them to really concentrate the sugars and the proteins and get more of those reactions. And then the question is base malt. I'm a big fan of Maris Otter and Golden Promise in bigger, darker beers. You wouldn't think that a slightly toastier base malt would make much of a difference, but it really adds this surprising depth to the flavor you get from the roasted malts. Early on, when I was helping Modern Times out with their Black House Stout recipe, we tried a version with Maris Otter as the base that was head and shoulders above the previous one we'd done with American Two-Row. That just had this depth of cocoa, chocolatey, coffee kind of flavors with the same specialty malts and everything. And it took some tweaking, and we ended up adding some biscuit malt, a few other things to kind of mimic that flavor. But as a home brewer, using a base of a good quality English pale malt, or I'm sure, I haven't done many of the pale ale malts that you could get from an American maltster, but that would be another good option too.
And if you're boiling for a longer time, those differences are going to maybe show up more than like a standard boil length, with a paler malt.
Yeah.
And
you're also just with these big beers, you're adding so much more total malt than you would that. I mean, for me, with a barley wine, you really don't need much specialty malt because you're adding so much high quality base malt that really ends up being a much more impactful ingredient than if you were making a 1040 bitter, where there's maybe 8 pounds of Maris Otter versus the Imperial Stout that you might be adding 20 pounds of Maris Otter.
Well, there's a lot to think about, and these can be tricky beers to brew.
Yeah, no, it's and so yeah, it's to me it's high quality ingredients. Watching the pH of your mash, being ready to add baking soda, I love chloride is great for mouthfeel and body and enhancing sort of the roundness of a beer like that. A little sodium doesn't hurt. I'd keep the gypsum low. I would keep, I don't think you need much magnesium or anything like that, but yeah. And then, you know, being able to generate all that wort, you know, plenty of oxygen, plenty of yeast for sort of the cleaner American, you know, giant stouts. We just use US05. You know, it's reliable. It's great attenuation. It's relatively inexpensive, you know, compared to using that much liquid yeast or having to grow up a starter. And yeah, we have had consistent, reliable fermentations from it, even, you know, up to, you know, 11% alcohol, and we haven't tried it past that.
Wow. Well, excellent. This has been a lot of fun. And it's good to get together and you know, let's not wait until another 18 months to do it again.
Yeah, hopefully we can get you up to the brewery at some point once this this all calms down and travel becomes a normal thing, and we can brew something or blend something or just drink something.
I would love it. I would love all that. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, James. Pleasure as always.
Well, thanks again to Mike. Be sure to check out the Mad Fermentationist blog at themadfermentationist.com. And, of course, check out Mike's book on brewing American sour beer. And if you're in the Columbia, Maryland area, stop by and see him and Scott Janish at Sapwood Cellars. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, disaster stories, or just want to say hi, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.